Welcome to In the Clear, Community Learning Exchange Advocacy Radio, with your hosts, Dr. John A. Oliver and Willie Anderson. Hello, thank you for joining us for In the Clear, Community Learning Exchange Advocacy Radio. My name is Willie Anderson. Saying hello, a big shout out to the good brother, Dr. John A. Oliver. We miss you here in Austin, but we know that you'll be sharing more programming with us. Today, I am going to share a conversation I had with Para Linnell Agboga, who serves as the Museum Site Coordinator and Theater Manager of the George Washington Carver Museum and Culture Center right here in Austin, Texas. Again, thank you for joining us for In the Clear. And now on to the conversation with Para Linnell Agboga.
So my name is Para Linnell Agboga, and I am been at the Carver for a long time. 18 years, 10 months.
18 years and 10 months.
18 years and 10 months. I'm counting down to that, you know, 19th birthday anniversary, I guess is a better word. Wow. Yeah. So, you know, when I came here, I was fresh out of college and didn't know anything about museums, except that I like to go to them. That was it. But I found a wealth of information at the Carver and a lot of things that could happen, a lot of opportunity. And I kind of got stuck. But the museum offers so many things to so many people. I think, you know, when a person walks in the front door, they are usually first struck with saying that the building is pretty. It's a nice building. Mm-hmm. And then there, of course, our galleries, which celebrate Juneteenth. Black Families of Austin, and we have a traveling gallery that highlights usually contemporary art, and sometimes there's a historical exhibit. Right now there's contemporary art in there, and actually features one of Austin's own, Deborah Roberts, and three other artists. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those are things that people see when they first get in here. And of course, we talk about Dr. Carver. You know, people always ask, did Dr. Carver teach here? Did he live here? No, he did not. And so there's a little story about why the museum is named after Dr. Carver, and it sounds funny, but it's very true. In 1933, when this historic building was actually moved here, the historic building was moved from downtown because it was the city's first library. It was moved over here because they got a new library, which today is the Austin History Center. Well, they didn't want to burn that old building. They just moved it over here and gave it to the black people. Hmm. And so we got the hand-me-down building, which at the time was okay, in the sense that at least we had a library because we couldn't go to the one downtown. Mm-hmm. So from 1933 to 1947, that building was simply called the Colored Library. Well, the people of the community got a little tired of that colored thing that was playing out. So they wanted to name it after somebody. Well, of course, there were a zillion people around here they could have named it after, but you know, that would have been contentious. Mm-hmm. So it's easier to choose somebody else that everybody admired. Dr. Carver had recently passed away in 1943, so it was very easy to name the building George Washington Carver. Nobody could disagree on that, mm-hmm. and everybody knew who that was. Exactly. And so that is how we got the name George Washington Carver Library, and then, of course, in later years, museum.
And nowadays, coming in, I noticed that it's very diverse.
Extremely.
Not just for African-American. In fact, there was a cultural event recently, I believe it was the Tejano. Mm-hmm. There were featured, yeah, Tejano music,
right,
and other,
right,
cultures as well.
Well, you know, part of the beauty of the Carver being a rental space is that it is open, and so a lot of different groups are able to use it. We recently have had several Middle Eastern groups here because they feel at home. This place is a nice place. It's beautiful, and they do feel like they're comfortable here. So that's one of the good things about it being, you know, open to the public, and our rental process it's not based on culture. Our programming is culture based, but you know, the rental program itself, where people can come in and just pay to use the space, is not. And so that really makes it nice because it does add to the diversity of the place. And I love it. I think we learn a lot. I learn a lot by, you know, hosting and seeing people playing Indian music, and we've had an Ethiopian group to come in recently and do some. I mean, it's just fascinating. You see all these different cultures come in and do their stuff. So we have a lot of fun with that. Really, that adds to the tapestry.
And I think of the word intimacy as well. the way the theater is set up.
Yes.
How many seats?
It's 134 seats in that space. And you know, of course, when we opened the building in 2005, people initially complained because they said it was too small. But we had to do what money we had. We had to work with that amount of money. And we also wanted to have a very big... We could have built a huge theater without any bells and whistles. But we built a smaller space that has all the bells and whistles. So it lends itself to live productions, to films, to concerts, to anything that you want to do in there, pretty much you can. And it is a very intimate space. It's very pretty. Every seat is perfect. Nobody can block your view. So the space is really it's a jewel. I mean, people come in here and they are amazed at that theater. And it is used all the time. The Carver is the most requested space of all the rental spaces in the Parks Department. This space is requested the most. So the Economic Development Department has told us. They have let us know that you all have, people want to come to the Carver.
And with that being said, you mentioned the fact that money in the rental space, is that one of the main ways that you get?
So we actually don't make a lot of money off of our rentals.
Okay.
People don't understand the way government works sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Those monies don't come back to the Carver. The only monies we get back are the monies that pay the temporary people who work here. But all that money that people pay does not come back to the Carver budget. It goes to what we call the city of Austin's big coffers. It goes there. It doesn't come back directly here. We are supposed to, you know, rent out a certain amount of times a year and there's a threshold that say you need to make at least this much. And we generally surpass it. Usually sometimes we double it. But that money does not come back to the Carver.
So what does keep Carver thriving?
The Carver is under the Parks Department. So the Parks Department is what's called a general fund department, meaning we don't have a lot of revenue. We're a service department. And so we really depend on city council giving us a certain amount of money to function throughout the year. So, of course, that covers all of the salaries, covers benefits, and it covers bills that this place makes, like electricity, and covers that. And there's a little, whatever's left over from all of that, which is not very much at all, is what we use for programming. So, you know, we depend heavily on collaborations. We depend on the community coming in and volunteering. We depend on a lot of those kinds of things to really bring our programming up to speed. And we keep our relationships with various organizations very strong because they come in and help us out. So, you know, we're not a place that just because you see people here all the time and there's always a bunch of cars in the parking lot doesn't mean the car is making hand over fist of money. It's actually, that's not the way it's designed. So, you know, if this was a private sector, yes, we could charge and we would be making a lot of money, but that's not the way it's set up.
So even with the donation box?
Donations are different. Donations come in and we can take those in, but, you know, fees for the rental spaces are far higher than what people are going to donate. So, yeah. So, and we encourage people donate. And of course, we can't go around requiring that people donate to walk in the door. We can't charge a price for people to go into the galleries. So we just depend on the goodness of people, and we hope that our programming is good enough and our tours and our exhibits are good enough where people want to donate.
How do you go about with the program, developing those programs, the vision for the Carver?
So, you know, that it's twofold. We have professionals in the building who understand the importance of educating the community in African and African American issues and history. And then, of course, we want to hear from what the community wants. So a lot of times we, in our day-to-day conversing with people who walk through the doors, talking with teachers, talking with parents, and talking with kids, you know, we get a feel of, oh, there's a need for X type of programming. And so we come back to the table and we try to formulate and develop something that will answer those things that we think we've heard. We also have community engagement processes where we hear directly from the community. We have one coming up actually in a couple of weeks where we will really and truly sit down with the community and discuss what is it that you want from us. Because here again, we're a service area. So we want to serve by giving the community what they want as much as we can. Now, you know, we can't give all the silver, but we do want to make sure that we engage with the community and give and offer classes and programs that people are going to take hold of. You know, we could think that our programming is wonderful, but if nobody walks in the door to take hold of it, it's just dead programming. So we have to work with the community and know what is it that you want. And that way there's an even exchange And then we know what you said. You know what you said. There's a record of it. And we can come back and to the drawing board and draw out what the community has said they want to see here. So it is a never-ending task. Mm-hmm. As you know, our community is changing. They are, I hate to use the word dwindling, but you know, they're not so much so in Austin the way they used to be.
And there's this, our culture, and I will just say our, because yeah, we are talking about Soul City here.
Yes.
And it was developed with the concept of what is keeping African-Americans here and what is sending us away.
Mm-hmm.
What are these cultural things that we have to keep the strength of our roots
right
growing?
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the Carvers tried to, I think over the years, and I've been here long enough to see the neighborhood change, to see the city change. And I'm involved enough with the community. I don't go to work and then just go home. I'm bouncing around. And you hear people talk, and you realize that what people really want is they want somewhere to call home.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess a good example of that would be our churches, the churches that are here. And many of these churches, especially located in the heart of East Austin, many of them have outgrown their spaces. And so you've got Greater Mount Zion, you have David Chapel, you have all these places that are building new facilities.
Yes.
The interesting thing that I find is that all of those places are building their facilities further east. They're not going to Pflugerville, they're not going to Mena, they're not going to Hays County. They're staying as east as possible, and they're just less than 3 miles away from their original home.
Right.
And I think that's because the reality is this area has a lot of significance for Black folks. It just does. Mm-hmm. And no matter where we end up living, we always want to have a homecoming. Sometimes it's a weekly homecoming to church.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it may be a monthly homecoming to the Carver.
Yes.
It may be, you know, every 6 weeks homecoming to your beauty shop. Wherever it is, it is that homecoming, that sense of homecoming. And so the Carver represents that as well. I take it extremely seriously. I understand that the Carver really serves as a beacon, because as everything around here is changing, and those changes, you know, I don't look at them and say, well, they're meant to be evil or they're meant to be harsh, but they are realities. And the reality is those changes, especially for those people who have been here for a while and who know the history, those changes can have an emotional reaction or make you have an emotional reaction. They're sometimes a little hurtful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go by the building that, and maybe it was a dilapidated building, and now it's all built up and it's a pretty condo.
Absolutely.
But still, you say, but you know, what used to be there was, you know, that's where, you know, Big and Benny used to hang out, you know.
So it's a connection.
It's a connection there.
Spiritual and community. It's not just a building.
It's not just a building. And so I think the Carver does serve as this place where, you know, there's still a sense of we were here and we're still here and we're still thriving. And what people have done over the years still matters, and what they're going to do matters. And so this place is extremely vital to that connection.
You spoke about how you and your colleagues are together. Say you're at a table and discussing these upcoming events. For instance, I want to ask about the holiday season.
Okay.
How do y'all decide those type of...
You know, we start planning that stuff a year out, sometimes a little more than a year out. We talk about things that are like hot point issues at the moment. You know, for example, last year when we were talking, we anticipated that the presidential season would be upon us, or the election season, not the president, the election season. And we would need to make sure that, you know, maybe we even if we didn't have any programming around that, we were sensitive to it. We're thinking, now, of course, we didn't know it was going to be as dramatic as it is. But, you know, but so we think like that. We try to think way, way in advance.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you want to talk about the holiday season, but the better example is Black history. You know, we can find the theme a year out. So a year out, we can be in a February and we're already planning the next February, because we're looking at the theme and we're saying, oh, we have, you know, all these different, we have this theme and these are the things that we can do. Here's some exhibits we can plan around. We just try to make it work to where we're not playing catch up, we're being proactive as opposed to reactive.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, we're able to hit it on the nail. you know, and get it together. Sometimes we bomb. You know, not every event has, you know, standing room only. Sometimes a couple of people turn up and we're like, what happened, you know? But we really do try to work with bouncing ideas that we've heard around the community, ideas that we have individually. A lot of times we merge ideas. Sometimes we're shocked that we have the same idea. Mm-hmm. And we pull it together, though. I think we have a strong team. We do. We have a lot of people who know their area of expertise very well. Mm-hmm. And so together we can bridge a lot of things and make a lot of things work.
What about the community and the volunteers? You mentioned those people.
You know, we have those people who come in on a regular basis and volunteer. We wish there were more. We try to encourage, especially retired people, if you're bored, we got something for you to do. Okay. We love to have people who just are willing to work and serve and do it selflessly. That's of course, for any museum and cultural center, that's the best thing you could hear, is somebody wants to come in and work for free. It's a wonderful thing. And you know, really, I think the best time that we have volunteers is when we have larger events. People tend to want to, you know, work on those. And I think that's anywhere people like to work the big events. They don't necessarily want to come in once a week, mm-hmm. but they want to work a big event, which is okay. We still want those once a week people to come in.
What has been the most intriguing event that has occurred here as far as programming and
shows? Oh my gosh.
For you, from your perspective?
From my perspective, you know, we've had
18 years.
Yeah, that's a lot to dig into. But let's see. A few years ago, Barbara Conrad was here. Barbara Conrad is an opera singer who went to the University of Texas and actually was refused a role. I forgot the opera she was trying to, she had auditioned for, but she was the better singer. But because she was black, she was not given that role. Ended up being a world famous opera singer. And it's so interesting now, the University of Texas just rolls out the red carpet for her, but so she was in town for a university event, and because we keep close ties with our community and with people and with organizations, and so we have a very close relationship with the University of Texas, and I know that sounds odd, but we do. And so over the years we have always had an exchange of artists and spaces and programming. And so it was agreed that she would spend an evening here at the Carver. And that time, what we did was we worked not only with UT, but we also worked with HT to bring in their music students. Because it was like, okay, you know, why not have, because obviously the UT music students are going to have, you know, some time with her, but what about HT? So we had a full house. She came in, there was an interview, and she was so grand, and she was totally just, it was almost like having Queen Elizabeth here. She was royalty. And so somewhere toward the middle of the interview, she brought up a student from HT, and the young lady sang beautifully. Mm. And then Barbara Conrad gave her some points in front of the audience. Mm. And she said, here's some things you can work on. But the girl, I mean, of course, I was sitting there going, what she need to work on? She's good. But anybody can, you know, use some work. So Barbara Conrad gave her some pointers. And that was just, you know, it was so amazing. It was just a beautiful thing to see. That was history coming together. That was the future coming together, merging with history. It was an awesome event. And it was just wonderful to see. And so that was a programming thing. And then other things just drop in our lap, and you know, we're always like, we're just at the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. So a few years ago, I guess must have been like 6 years ago now, the mayor at the time was Lee Leffingwell, and he had made this promise that he was gonna have city council meetings around the city.
Yeah,
that sounded great on the campaign trail. But in theory, like it's in practice, rather, it wasn't easy. So the first place they were going to have an off-site council meeting was Carver. Mm-hmm. So it was months. This is a meeting, but it took months to plan, because mm-hmm. there's a lot of technical stuff that goes with it. There's a lot of other stuff that you, if you're not in there, you don't know that they have to have a room for this and they have to have a room for that. And all these little I's and T's, and it was just, it was a big deal. So we I worked with that, with their team over there. We worked to get a lot of things done. Then in the middle of us planning it, another piece just said kerplunk and it couldn't be taken out. The Dominican Republican president was coming to Austin the same day as city council meeting, and he had to meet the mayor. Well, the mayor wasn't going to go back over to City Hall, so the Dominican Republican president was going to have to come here. So it was a whole new thing. And then, of course, because of the laws of the State Department, Secret Service has to be involved because there's a state dignitary here because of the president. So we had to work with Secret Service. We had to work with APD. It was just like, and so suddenly I was looped into something that I had not anticipated, but ended up being so rewarding. I won't forget Ms. Viper and I standing outside with the mayor and some other people waiting for the Dominican president to roll up in his SUV. And we stood out there like, you know, I don't know, the serfs on the at the kingdom waiting for the king to get out. And so he comes in and we, you know, had a little chit chat. We exchanged a few words. And of course, there were pictures flashing and TV cameras lined up. It was just amazing. It was like, you know, how did this end up being here? But it was just one of those things that just, it was one of those drop in your lap moments. What else can you do? You just roll with it. And I might say that was probably one of the most successful. They did three of those offsite things that I've talked to people, of course, you know, who worked with it. And they were like, the Carver was the best spot. So it was, that was a feather in my cap that I held on to for a minute, you know, that we had helped to make, pull all that off. And work with Secret Service, and it was just, it's one of those things.
Let's go back to the beginning of your career. You said you were stuck here. It sounds like you've grown here.
Yeah, so.
And so how has this been for you?
So I got a degree in theater. When I got back, I went to Prairie View A&M, which I'm very proud of. And my last spring at Prairie View, the theater group, the Charles Gilpin Players, were honored to go to the Kennedy Center to perform. And I was assistant director for Offenses. So that's the biggest thing you can do in college theaters, go to the Kennedy Center in D.C. And do your show. So riding off of that high, I graduated and got here in Austin. And, you know, I couldn't find a job.
Sounds familiar.
It was 1997. It was December. I was like, I cannot... I went and I had interned because for a little while I was a double major. I was theater and communication. So I actually had interned at KB24 and I'd interned at KLBJ AM News. And so I was like, well, you know, if I can't get a job in theater, which is, I probably won't, I can get a job in news. And so I rolled around this city and there were no openings, not anything that I was qualified to do at any of the news stations. So I was like stuck. And I didn't want to go, you know, working in retail. I didn't want to go work. I was like, that, I just can't see myself going to work for, you know, Dillard's. And I just got my degree. It's a little snotty. But my mother had said she was not going to pay for my car note anymore. So I had to get a job doing something. So I was looking in the Villager. And there was this posting for this. It was called, the title was Program Specialist at the Carver Museum. And I was like, oh, I like the museum. I'll go apply there. Maybe they'll hire me. Well, I came in December. Ms. Pfeiffer was sitting at her desk and she was like, how can I help you? And I was like, I want to apply for a job. I had been to the dentist's office, so my mouth was dead. And she was like, oh, okay, we can talk about it. And I was like, well, not right now. Not on today. She's like, no, we can talk today, you know. It's like, oh my gosh. So I sat down and my mouth is half dead. And we talked for about 30 minutes or so, and maybe 45 minutes. And I told her my background and she said, okay, well, why don't you go ahead and do your application and then come back and we'll, it looks like it may work. I was like, okay. 2 days later, I got a call. I had gotten a job. I was making $8.10 an hour.
But you got that job.
I got a job. So I went home and I told my mom, I'm making just enough to pay for my car note. So, and I honestly, I had no intentions of sticking around. I was like, I'm going to work here for a year and I'm going to get on up out of here. I ain't going to stay at the car. This is a great place, nice people, but, well, nice. There's only Ms. Viper, you know, so she was the only staff that I was really involved with. So it was just the two of us. And, I mean, I worked that year. And, you know, after right at a year, I did get an offer from KXAN 36 to work as an associate producer. And I took it, I submitted my resignation letter, and I will never forget Ms. Pfeiffer sitting there for a long time, and she said, "Are you sure this is what you want to do?" And I said, "It's news. Love news. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to do." And she said, "Well, I think you really would have a great future with the city. So think about it over the weekend." That was a Friday. I thought about it, and I prayed about it over the weekend. And, you know, because I worked at Tuesday through Saturday schedules. Tuesday, I came in, and I took my resignation back, and I wrote KXA in, and I said, "I've changed my mind. I'm going to stay with the city of Austin." And, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So that's one of those little tidbits. I was going to ask you some unknown fact that maybe you would want to share.
That's a little... Most people would probably never... Well, I don't talk about it that much, but yeah.
But that explains, too, because I've heard you speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is the longest I've heard you speak, but I've heard you speak before. I've said, "She is awesome."
Well, thank you.
So the presence, stage presence, which in theater, were you... What aspect of theater were
you? So, you know, when I went to college, I intended to just perform. Mm-hmm. And then I figured out, you know, I'm not a bad performer, but I'm a better director. And so I kind of changed my concentration kind of midway through to be more on the side of directing and producing than actually on the stage. And so when I got to town, and I got involved with theater companies, even though I was like creating prices. And at first, when I came to Austin, I was doing theater. It was just, "I'll just do it for free. Mm-hmm. I'll stage manage your show for free. I'll do your lights for free." And I did a lot of that. And after a couple of years, I started charging. So I would charge to direct plays. I would charge to be in them. And I got involved with Boy Vance, and that was really nice. And so in his company, I actually acted and directed. So I acted in the Color Museum. I'm going to say Color Purple. The Colored Museum. Hmm. I love that. I did Lala. Love that show. Yeah. Lala was probably my favorite character. Huh. And then I was Ruth in Raising the Sun.
I need to do research. And that's the thing. Being educated through your work.
Yeah. You know, it was... Hmm. And so, you know... The whole time I was doing those things, I was also working. So there was never an interruption of service with the city. It was always just other stuff. And I started, once I got married and pregnant, then I started acting. No, that's not true. I directed one show. I directed Amen Corner right before I got married. Then afterwards, I was always just directing because it was a little easier to direct when you had those little bad babies running around. So it's just easier that way. And you know, that was a big help though, because then I never lost the touch of doing theater stuff, even though, you know, when I came to work, I wasn't doing theater initially. I was, because you know, this place wasn't built. Mm-hmm. So I kept my theater stuff going, okay. Kept it moving so that when they built this facility and it had the theater, I was able to apply for that job and say, "I can manage that theater."
Got it.
Yeah.
It all came together. And speaking of your family, your children are growing up in historical moments. I mean,
yeah, I got a 14-year-old and almost 13, and then a 10-year-old. Mm-hmm. So the girls are, Cecilia will be 13 in a month. Carrie just turned 14 this week.
Hmm.
Yes, my children are growing up around me. And, you know, they have been exposed. I don't know how exposed they've been.
They performed here.
Carrie's picture is in the gallery, because when we were putting together the exhibits for the main gallery, we decided we needed to have some kind of young picture for Juneteenth. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so we couldn't find any. Like, we couldn't find any that we could actually get the rights to use.
Right.
Because there was one that and there was a little boy who was eating a watermelon. We couldn't find the photographer to get the rights to use that photo. So finally, Miss Pfeiffer said, "Well, just take a picture of Carrie with a watermelon." Carrie was about 9 months old.
Oh.
So I put her on the front lawn, and I got a watermelon, and I let her sit on it and eat on it and lean on it. And so finally, we chose the lean on it picture, and we put that in the gallery. So
okay.
when she has her friends here at the Carver, she says, "Oh, I'm in the gallery," and she takes them in there. Okay. So they're just inundated with culture, and they see stuff here all the time. They go places all the time and seeing cultural stuff. They really are just, sometimes I wonder if they're too infused, but they get a chance to be exposed to a lot. it's the beauty of having a parent to work in a museum. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You just know stuff that you don't even know is important to know. Mm-hmm. So they're fortunate, but they don't know how fortunate. They won't know they're fortunate until probably they're about 40.
Well, there are other children that I know. You have photography classes. There are the drum classes. I've been here for the dance.
Yeah,
all no, those different things. The young and the even the our older generations. So.
We have something from 2 to 92. There's something for you to do here at the Carver. Actually, in December, we will have our Silver Bell Social, which is an annual event that happens. And that's the concert where Pam Hart sings and James Polk plays the piano. And they do Christmas songs and they do some jazz pieces. And it's all for senior citizens. And then we have a little reception for them afterward. It's great. It's wonderful.
Any tidbits that you want to add? Any jewels?
Well, just that, you know, the Carver really is, it is a home place. You know, I used to, when we worked in the historic building, we had carpet on the floor. And I used to have this awful habit of taking off my shoes when nobody was there. And then one day, somebody came into my office and sat down, and she noticed I had my shoes off. And she said, oh, I'm going to take my shoes off too. And she took her shoes off, and she sat there, and we just chatted in my office. But I often think back on that, because the Carver is a place where you can take off your shoes. You know, it's a home place. There's something for you to learn. There's something for you to do. And there's something for the family to do. This is a family-oriented facility. And I know that that may seem like it's shutting people out, but in fact, it's doing the very opposite. Because if it's something for the family, that means that everybody can find something that interests them. Yeah, yeah. So, and we really like to be an integral part of people's lives. We like, it doesn't mean you come here every day, but it means that, you know, there are some key things that you want to come here for all the time. And when you bring your family in town, you say, oh, let's go to the Carver. Let's spend an hour or so there and see what's going on. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that kind of, that's what we strive to be. Mm-hmm. And that's what we hope we are to people who live here and who visit here. I would like for the Carver to be one of the places that you have to come to when you come to Austin.
Yes.
You know, that place that you say, oh no, if I go to Austin, I got to go by the Carver. That's what I would love to see.
I'm just backtracking. I remember a movie in the park. Was that sponsored by the library or by both?
That was the museum thing, the parks department. Yeah, we did the museum in the park.
Yes.
Yeah, that was really neat. You know, it was a neat thing that we did for a while. I don't know if black folk like to be outside too much because it did.
I enjoyed it. But now,
right? Now, we had movies in the theater. People like flocked to it. But when we say outside, they're like, oh,
the film
no.
festivals, the book festivals.
Right.
You have these inside and
outs. And out. Yeah. Now, the book festival's in and out. And people really love the book festival. That's mm-hmm. And we're not. The Folktales does that, but of course we are partners with them.
Right, because we're here.
It's here, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, and we just love that event. That event is one of the things that, I mean, I look forward to it every year because I'm like, what author's coming this year? Mm-hmm. You know? So.
I'm a little biased on that one for sure. So I really appreciate it. And is there anything else? I mean, I asked that before. Just, I want to be able to share some things.
You know,
I think we covered.
I think we covered a lot. I didn't talk about my favorite program, though.
I want you to.
I don't have a favorite program. I shouldn't say that.
I asked you about other things that came in, but yes.
So, you know, in 2008, Erica Jones, who works, she's the dean of students at HT now, but she wasn't at the time, but she is now, came in and she wanted to do a theater camp. And I looked at her thing and I said, so you're going to do all this. She wanted to rent the space. I said, you want to do all this by yourself? And she was like, well, I don't have anybody to help me. And I was like, well, I'm planning a theater camp too. So why don't we just do it together?
Collaboration.
Well, what I did was I pitched the idea to Ms. Pfeiffer as just making it a Carver program, not even a collaboration, just making it a program.
Ah, got it.
That way it would be, all the monies would be taken in, you know, to the city. It would all be under the city's. And so I think she was a little reluctant at first, but so that year we started out, we had 9 kids and I was supposed to have 10 to start it. But I begged. I was like, it seems like it's a bit enough. We did some little knockoff script offline, but we pulled it off. The next year we did Wizard of Oz. I think we had 23 kids to enroll that next year.
Excellent.
The next year we had 36 kids to enroll. And the next year we had 57.
What is the one you did this year?
This year we did Annie Jr. and Aladdin Jr.
It's
yeah.
growing.
So it got so big that we can no longer do one show. We had to do two shows. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we have over 70 kids every summer. And they flock in here like crazy. And that program is so amazing that those kids get to come here and they can learn to act, sing, and dance, yes. make props, do a full-fledged show, technical, whole nine yards. And when they walk out of here, they've got something under their belt that they've accomplished over the summer. And, I mean, what is better than that? You know, it's just, it's a wonderful thing. Yeah. Yeah. And so even though there's a cost associated with that program, we try to keep it very low. And people love it. They come here with that, just like there's a waiting list, you know, and I'm so, so proud of that program. I think it's at this point is probably the Carver's signature youth program.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
And this has been another edition of In the Clear, Community Learning Exchange Advocacy Radio. On behalf of the good brother, Dr. John A. Oliver, I'm Willie Anderson signing off. Until next time, please stay in the clear. We especially enjoy playing.